Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. On the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community, I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunlay. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an update on the union organizing effort at Capitol Roots. Then for our peace segment, we hear about why Veterans of Peace are marching in Albany's Memorial Day Parade. Later on, we have an update on the congressional reps for the Capitol District, Hudson Valley, and the North Country. After that, Casey Polamain, Executive Director of The Barn, talks to us about the Wildwood Art Showcase and more. And we finish with a story about Gabby's Garden in Albany. But first, headlines.
A 15-year-old high school student faces a felony charge after police said she threatened a school shooting on social media over a school policy she was upset about.
The Times Union reports that the state has awarded $13 million for 11 projects in the Capital District to try to transform blighted properties into potential hubs for economic growth. In Schenectady, a former Honda dealership at 754 State Street will be demolished to make way for a commercial building, including a grocery store. Troy will receive $2.6 million to replace a former bank branch with a 55,000 square foot, 70 unit, four story apartment building at 1818 Fifth Avenue, and Rensselaer will receive $2 million. To convert the former McManus School at 20 Herrick Street into 49 apartments and commercial spaces.
General Electric plans to hire 200 people to work at a new $50 million onshore wind turbine assembly line at the company's downtown plant.
A medical examiner could not determine the cause of 14-year-old Samantha Humphrey's death. The high school student went missing on November 25th after meeting up with her ex-boyfriend in Riverside Park in Schenectady's Stockade neighborhood.
While Albany County is the latest to declare a state of emergency over the migrant housing crisis, it does not seek a ban on providing such housing, does not call for a ban on migrants coming to the county. Instead, it directs the county's Department of Social Services to work with the state to plan for the relocation of up to 200 families. It does require the state to reimburse the county for its costs and prohibits groups or businesses from bringing in migrant asylum seekers without the county's permission. Other local counties, such as Rensselaer and Greene, have issued emergency orders that ban migrants from being housed in local businesses.
Health officials are predicting a rough 2023 tick season in upstate New York. Ticks come out early this year as a result of mild weather and early snow melt. The season typically starts in April, peaks in late spring, and ends in October. That's it for headlines.
We start today's show with Mark speaking with Sean Collins, the local organizer for SEIU, about the effort to secure a union contract with the nonprofit Capitol Roots.
Joined by Sean Collins, who is the union rep organizer for SEIU, Local 200 United, and among a number of organizing campaigns they're doing here in the Capital District. One of them has been with respect to Capitol Roots, formerly known as, I believe, Capitol District Community Gardens. And while Capitol Roots initially had agreed to voluntarily represent or recognize the union, now they have rescinded that. So Sean, what's the situation? Wasn't this about 9-10 months ago that they had said they were okay with forming a union?
Yeah, back in July of last year, they had agreed to voluntarily recognize our union, the workers' union, rather. And you know, we were hopeful that this would be a good example to, you know, to show, you know, other workers in the Capital District that, you know, the organizing process doesn't have to be so contentious and rife with union busting. But instead, after voluntary recognition, Amy Klein, the CEO, and her management team instead turned the screws on the workers. And, it's since, you know, we've had to file a number of charges, unfair labor practice charges with the National Labor Relations Board. As a result, she, you know, unlawfully terminated two employees who were key to the organizing effort and what we believe was retaliatory retaliation for their organizing. She withheld, you know, merit increases from various employees and otherwise just, you know, engaged in a pattern of union busting and retaliation and intimidation to the point where now none of the workers that were initially part of the organizing drive work there anymore. And so, you know, that brings us to just last week when, you know, her and the board unlawfully withdrew recognition of our union.
And, you know, reading in the Times Union, which, you know, did an article about this, one of the things I noticed, it seemed like, you know, half the workers' positions are not, you know, filled at this point. So it seemed like they just, you know, either pushed out or let go a lot of workers. What are the workers feeling like at this point?
It's a good question. You know, I'm sure that the current staff there are, you know, it's been very tumultuous. The few staff that have been hired since this all took place, I'm sure it's been very tumultuous and they've been stretched very thin. But, you know, that's a direct result of Amy's actions. We were prepared to bargain a reasonable contract that, you know, hopefully increased pay and provided, you know, better job security and better stability for the workforce. And as a result of that, better stability for the communities that Capital Roots served. But Amy wasn't willing to bargain in good faith really refused to genuinely, you know, meet with us in good faith to work towards an agreement. Here's where we find ourselves. We've had, you know, limited contact with these new employees. And as we understand it, there's been, even with the new employees that they've hired, that there's been significant turnover. People are, you know, they accept a job and then they find that they're working in a chaotic environment. So they don't stay very long, which is, you know, one of the key issues that we were trying to address if we could get to the bargaining table and have a reasonable conversation. But that just wasn't ever possible.
Now, my assumption is that a group like, you know, Capital Roots, which is a nonprofit, you know, receives a lot of its funding either from various, you know, government grants or from, mm-hmm. you know, local foundations. Have, you know, elected officials and, you know, their board of directors and their funders, have they stepped in to say, hey, you know, you should be more sympathetic to the workers and to the unions that represent them?
We've gotten an incredible amount of support from local elected officials, the Albany Common Council, Detroit, you know, members of the Troy City Council, members of the Troy Rensselaer County Legislature, various local state assembly members, Pat Fahey, John McDonald, Assemblymember McDonald has been incredibly helpful. So they've been really supportive of this and concerned about what's been going on there. As I understand it, I don't know the specifics here, but I do understand that the Department of Health has been scrutinizing the grants that they provide Capital Roots, but I can't really speak to that. But I would say that they should. I don't think that, you know, Capital Roots, you know, Amy and her management team can accurately say that they are delivering on the grants that they have because they don't have the staff to do so. That they've had a high degree of turnover, that we've heard from various, you know, organizations and entities that they partner with, that the services have been impacted. And we've heard from folks who, you know, say that Veggie Mobile isn't there when it says it's going to be, you know, in its different locations. A lot of the vendors they work with, you know, have reported to us that, like, since the staff exodus that took place over the latter part of last year, that, like, it has had a direct impact on the services that they used to rely on Capital Roots for.
Now, I understand that, you know, some of the initial complaints by the staff was, you know, relatively low pay, and they would like to, a little bit more say in what the organization is doing. Have any of those issues, been improved since the organizing effort started?
Well, it's it's a sort of a double-edged sword. The management of the organization, including Amy, seem to agree that the way that they paid folks, was too little, and it was leading to certain turnover, and they understood that they needed to do something in terms of pay, but they never bargained with us over it. But all these vacancies that they have online for their events coordinator, for their volunteer coordinator, they unilaterally, as near as we could tell, they've unilaterally changed the pay. They increased the pay by a modest like $2,000 annually, but they never did that with any bargaining. You can't, in an environment where collective bargaining, where they've agreed that voluntarily to engage in collective bargaining with our union, they never once approached us to raise this pay, which not that we necessarily object to them increasing pay, but it doesn't waive their obligation to bargain with us and negotiate any change in the terms and conditions of employment. So arguably this increase in pay is unlawful. We intend to, follow through with the National Labor Relations Board on this, unilateral change, on these unilateral changes. As near as we could tell, there's at least 3 to 5 positions where they've unilaterally increased the pay for these positions and maybe even unilaterally changed the benefits that you get when you're as an employee at Capital Roots, never engaging in any bargaining with the union.
So what happens now, and what can people who are both supportive of the union and supportive of the concept, at least of the task of Capital Woods, what can people do now, and how does this play out in the last 90 seconds?
Yeah, so we expect the National Labor Relations Board to get back to us hopefully this week with a merit determination on the charges that we previously filed with the board. We believe that they will find merit in those charges. And, that with that merit determination, that means that we can finally start to hold, Amy accountable for her law breaking. But we also intend to this week file additional charges with the National Labor Relations Board. Withdrawing union recognition is just plainly illegal. There's no question about it. Especially in an environment where there are a bunch of unremedied unfair labor practice charges. So we intend to file charges regarding that, and also with the other unilateral changes that they've made to pay and benefits. Amy can't just simply reverse course here and say like, I don't want to deal with them anymore. That's not how this process works, and it's not how it will work. Troy is a union town. We're not going to let her get away with union busting. And what I would say sort of finally is that like the best thing Amy could do for the mission and reputation of Capital Roots would be to resign. It would save everybody a lot of time and energy, and it allow the folks to get back to the work of the organization that unfortunately, because of her actions, there's been a real negative impact on the services they provide to the community.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Sean Collins, local organizer, SEIU. Local 200 United, talking about Capital Roots. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And we will continue to bring our listeners stories about local organizing efforts, Capital Roots, Amazon, Starbucks, and other efforts.
For our Peace Bucket, Dan Wilcox explains why Veterans for Peace is marching on Monday in Albany's Memorial Day Parade.
For this week's Peace Bucket, we're joined by Dan Wilcox of Veterans for Peace. Now, Veterans for Peace traditionally has joined in the Memorial Day Parade in Albany to show that there are veterans who strongly believe in the need for peace. So, Dan, what are some of the, details about the upcoming delegation, and can people join in?
Yes, that's true. The parade is one of two parades the city of Albany does around the themes of veterans and, unfortunately, the military, Memorial Day and Veterans Day in November. We've been marching for many years in the parade, and the parade is organized by a group of veterans organizations, but we've been accepted for many years by them. So the parade this year will be held on Monday, May 29th. And once again, Veterans for Peace, the Tom Paine chapter number 10, will be marching, or I like to say walking, because I'm not marching anymore, to remember those who have died, both civilian and military, in wars present and past, and to bring our message of peace and the goal to abolish war to the event. We are inviting all those opposed to war to join us to work for peace. Please bring signs and banners with messages of peace and maintain a peaceful, peace-loving demeanor while in the parade and beyond. And we're inviting people from any group or no group, but just that they agree with that idea. We will gather on that morning, May 29th, Monday, May 29th, at the corner of Central Avenue and Partridge Street in Albany at 9 a.m. And then the parade will start off at about 9:30 and proceed east on Central Avenue and continue east on Washington Avenue to Hawk Street. And over the years, our presence has really delivered a strong message that resonates with the spectators along the parade route. So if anyone's anxious about our reception, we always get a good reception, and we are accepted by the veterans organizations as well. So we invite anyone who believes in peace to walk with us, and you can bring a sign if you want. You don't have to. Just your presence there is what's important.
Now, to a certain extent, Veterans for Peace, the name is, you know, sort of self-explanatory. But, you know, maybe what are some of the key goals? I understand you actually call to the end of all wars.
Yes, that is the basic aim of the Veterans for Peace is to abolish war. It's just that veterans, particularly those who have actually fought in combat. I didn't. I was the lucky one. I was drafted during Vietnam, but not sent over there. But particularly combat vets, I won't say all, but many combat vets feel very strongly that what they saw was horrific and should never happen again. So that's what got the Veterans for Peace going. Veterans for Peace has also been involved in other issues because they're all connected, as we know. For example, during the Black Lives Matter events a few years ago, the Veterans for Peace was at probably every demonstration all across the country, because there are thousands of us across the country. And they were also involved in the environmental movement. War is a great polluter of the earth. So if anyone's really interested to see how it's all written up by the organization, you can just go to veteransforpeace.org and it's all there.
Now, you mentioned earlier that many veterans, particularly combat veterans, who've actually experienced war, you know, just are opposed to war in general. And one of the issues has divided a fair amount of the peace community in the United States is, you know, whether or not, you know, I think most people say, you know, Russia was wrong to have sent troops in, invaded Ukraine. United States was wrong to have provoked over the years Russia into such a misadventure. But, you know, many peace groups, but not all, say, but what we should not be doing is, you know, supplying weapons to any combatants because that just leads to more people dying. How do you feel about that? And how do you respond to people say, well, what about the right to self-defense?
Well, that's essentially the way I feel, is that if I'm a peace activist, how can I support sending weapons of war to any other country? And while, you know, Russia was wrong to do the invasion, people who say, well, the United States provoked them, that defense is, what do the lawyers call it in a trial? That defense is the devil made me do it. And, you know, Russia made a bad choice. the international community, like the UN or any of these larger, and all the major powers in the world, are really complicit in all of this, in that they have to stop war. You know, I can go out on a street corner and stand there, and we can march in the parade and with our peace signs and all that, but can't do it. We really, as an individual, can't do the actual thing of stopping wars, whereas international community, international diplomatic community, that's their job, and I think they should be doing it. And to make a differentiation between, you know, personal violence, I'm not a pacifist, but I'm against war. And the distinction I like to draw is that if I have an argument with somebody and we get in, and maybe somebody punches me in the nose and maybe I punch them back. But then we don't go and then burn the person's house down. We don't go and then destroy their neighborhood or the school where their children go or the hospital in the neighborhood. The conflict is dealt with on an individual level. But what makes war so horrible is that people who really have nothing to do with it, other than the fact that they live in a particular place, are victims of that. And that, to me, is what the horror of war is, that it's not a matter of resolving a conflict between two individuals. It's these major powers. And right now we have the ability with the atomic weapons, United States, Russia, and other countries in the world who have nuclear weapons to destroy the Earth and destroy everybody on it. So, and if you want to provide arms to another country, for example, the Ukraine, and you want them to win, you want them to defeat the other guy, the only logical result of that is giving them an atomic bomb, which I know we're not going to do, but it's absurd just to give them some fighter planes or something and kind of pat them on the back and wish them good luck.
Well, we're almost out of time. Let me get a last question in. I remember a lot of the veterans groups were very active on the issue of depleted uranium, which particularly was in some of the weapons that were in Iraq and veterans came back and had health concerns. So what about this idea? I guess the United Kingdom is now sending weapons with depleted uranium over to the Ukraine. That a good idea or bad idea?
That's a bad idea. I mean, just on the weapons alone, but the depleted uranium is diabolical. And what it does to the environment. And again, to say it again, you know, war is horrible for the environment. And if you're an environmentalist, you certainly should have no position where you would want to support any war.
So if people want more information about Veterans of Peace and they can join you on the 29th, what, start at 9 o'clock?
Yes, that's right. We welcome people to join us and work for peace.
You got a website?
No. No, we don't.
Okay.
But I can give you my email address if you want. I can. If people want to write it down, I'll repeat it. It's dwlcx46@gmail.com. Again, dwlcx46@gmail.com.
Thank you very much. Dan Wilcock, Veterans of Peace, well-known local poet. And this is Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So I recently read a statement from former President Harry Truman, a little bit before most of our times, but he noted that Congress issued a joint resolution on May 1950 that Memorial Day, which had long been set aside for paying tribute to those who lost their lives in war, shall in the future be dedicated as a day for nationwide prayer for permanent peace. So I hope we're all praying for peace on Memorial Day. And for those just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Sina Bazilahiki. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. If you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org. Next is this week's WGXC Congressional Report tracking the votes, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional seats in the listening area.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and Philip Grant up in Rensselaer County and I are bringing you the WGXC Congressional Report, full of stories about what the candidates and representatives from the New York 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional districts have been up to this past week. Go to WGXC.org in the WGXC newsroom for complete coverage of your congressional representative.
The Troy Record reports that Representative Paul Tonko is crowing about the $936,414 the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Center for Substance Abuse Treatment has awarded the University at Albany for screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment to prevent and address gambling among college students. Tonko, a Democrat representing Albany County and the 20th Congressional District, has taken up gambling as his own cause lately. Tonko is trying to ban online and television advertising of sports gambling, but his H.R. 967 bill has no co-sponsors. But he is happy that UAlbany is getting more than $4.8 million over the next 5 years to support that research. Tonko said, and I quote, "This funding will help ensure that young adults who are struggling with these issues have access to the timely and responsive support that they need to lead healthy and fulfilling lives," end quote. Tonko serves as co-chair of the Addiction Treatment and Recovery Caucus, a bipartisan group of legislators committed to advancing solutions to the country's multifaceted addiction crisis. Read more about this story in the Troy Record. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that a report released this week by the Dutchess County Comptroller's Office said that a government lease of a luxury vehicle by former Republican Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro gave the, and I quote, "appearance of circumventing normal legislative approval as required by purchase and public transparency," end quote. Dutchess County Comptroller Robin Lois, a Democrat, wrote the report and focused on an inventory of county vehicles between 2018 and 2023. The summary in the report said, and I quote, "the report also addresses the 2021 lease of a $75,876 Chevy Tahoe by the county executive and identifies the execution of said lease after a 2020 purchase denial as giving the appearance of circumventing normal legislative approval as required by a purchase and public transparency. Leasing decisions should be held to the same standards as any purchase in the procurement policy by assuring the prudent and economical use of public monies in the best interest of taxpayers of Dutchess County and to guard against extravagance. It is evident that the lease in question was not held to the standard expected of all departments," end quote. Molinaro did not comment on the report, but his advisor, Dave Cottolfamo, did, avoiding mentioning any specifics in the report, saying, and I quote, "Mark Molinaro's fiscal stewardship as county executive is indisputable. He cut taxes, improved the county's bond rating, and left his successor with significant reserves. This audit has been extensively reported on and thoroughly explained well before its release," end quote. The report showed how previously county executive vehicles were purchased through bonding and budget requests and go through the legislature for approval, while Molinaro circumvented that process. Democrat Josh Reilly, who lost to Molinaro in 2022 and has announced another campaign for the 19th Congressional District in 2024, said, and I quote, "It's ironic that Mark Molinaro is lecturing voters about reckless spending even as an independent audit concludes that he wasted taxpayers' hard-earned money on a luxury vehicle for himself, end quote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. Tyler A. McNeil reports for the Daily Gazette that Republican Liz Joy will not run for a third term against Democrat Paul Tonko for the 20th Congressional District. Joy is a right-wing Republican who lost in 2020 and 2022 to Tonko by a wide margin in the Capital Region District. Joy attended Trump's rally near the Capitol on January 6, 2021, though did not enter the House of Representatives during the attempted coup. Now Joy said on social media that she plans on turning her attention to advocate for state level, and I quote, election integrity, end quote, saying, and I quote, together we were able to bring serious national attention to the New York Capital Region 20th Congressional District, something that had never been done before. It is a direct result of citizen grassroots support, our strong common sense message, and daily interacting with the people that live here and work here, end quote. Albany County Republican Chair Randy Bashwinger said he was surprised that Joy won't run again, saying, and I quote, I'm sure we'll find somebody. It's going to be tough to find anybody as strong as she was, end quote. Joy lost to Tonko by about a 55-45% margin in 2022. Even though she was beaten by about 30,000 votes, Joy's attorney requested an audit of the election, which the state denied. Joy claims the voter rolls have never been, and I quote, formally audited, end quote. But New York State Board of Elections spokesperson Jennifer Wilson said in an email that Joy is, and I quote, factually incorrect, end quote, on the auditing process. Republican Elise Stefanik, who represents the 21st District, called Joy a, and I quote, dear friend, end quote, and I quote, inspiring patriot, end quote, and said, and I quote, I look forward to continuing to work with Liz Joy as she begins her next chapter to restore election integrity and to secure our elections in New York, end quote. Read more about this story in the Daily Gazette. Mid-Hudson News reports that seven men have come forth to say they were paid to act as homeless veterans displaced from upstate hotels by incoming immigrants. Men were staying at a homeless shelter in Poughkeepsie and said they were among 15 men recruited for the scam by the nonprofit Yit Foundation. They were told to pretend they were veterans that had been kicked out of the Crossroads Hotel in the town of Newburgh last week before the arrival of actual migrants bused there from New York City. Assemblyperson Brian Mahar now says he was duped by Yit Foundation's director, Sharon Tony Finch, who appears to have fabricated the entire story. Mayor said on May 19th, and I quote, when Sharon and several veterans explained to me their situation, I believed them at their word. I had absolutely no knowledge of any wrongdoing and believed that their stories were real until a phone conversation with Sharon yesterday afternoon when she explained to me that this did not happen the way she purported it to, end quote. The men said they were paid $200 and given food and alcohol to scam the public into believing that homeless veterans were being kicked out of shelters to make room for migrants. One of the homeless men said about Sharon Tony Finch, and I quote, she told us to act like we were the veterans that had been displaced. She told us that if asked, we were supposed to say we had been kicked out and Sharon found us rooms in Fishkill, end quote. The man also said that anyone in the group who was unwilling to answer was told to respond with, and I quote, I'm too traumatized to talk about it, end quote. The false story that migrants were displacing homeless veterans was repeated widely, both locally and nationally.
Local Representative Mark Molinaro was one of many politicians that amplified the false story. Molinaro quoted a New York Post story about the false story on May 12th, writing, quote, this is absolutely inexcusable and should not be happening in America. This is the result of incompetence and lack of compassion. This won't be tolerated, unquote. Molinaro, a Republican, then commented after the hoax was made public, saying, quote, the fabrication is so disheartening and wrong, it undermines the work of helping our veterans and makes more difficult our efforts to stop New York City from illegally moving migrants to upstate New York communities without resources or their approval. This must stop, unquote. Molinaro did not admit his own culpability in amplifying the false story.
Read the full story at Mid-Hudson News.
The Daily Freeman tracks the votes last week of Democrat Pat Ryan and Republican Mark Molinaro in the 18th and 19th congressional districts. The House on May 17th voted 221 to 204 to avoid a direct vote on expelling Representative George Santos from Congress. The freshman lawmaker from Long Island is under federal indictment on 13 charges of wire fraud, money laundering, theft of public money, and making false statements to Congress. Local Republicans Mark Molinaro and Elise Stefanik voted to adopt a Republican motion to refer a Democratic expulsion measure, House Resolution 114, to the Ethics Committee. The Ethics Committee is already looking into misconduct by Santos before and after his election to the House. So Republicans voted to avoid a vote on expulsion. Local Democrats Pat Ryan and Paul Tonko voted against the measure or in favor of holding an expulsion vote on Santos. Also on May 17th, the House voted 232 to 198 to pass H.R. 3091 that would allow federal law enforcement officers to buy firearms, including handguns and AR-15-style assault rifles, that federal agencies have retired from their arsenals. The police officers would be allowed as citizens to purchase retired firearms at fair market value for lawful civilian purposes. Currently, the Secret Service and Customs and Borders Protection must destroy or transfer to another agency weapons they retire from use. Locally, again, the score was partisan, with Republicans Molinaro and Stefanik voting for the measure and Democrats Ryan and Tonko voting against. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman.
This has been the WGXC Congressional Report, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional seats in New York. Go to WGXC.org for more information.
So we're going to be trying to play more segments in the future from our sister station down in the Upper Hudson Valley, WGXC, operated by Wave Farm. And I also note they talked about Sharon Tony Finch, who was responsible for this full story about migrants displacing veterans in some of the shelters in upstate. And earlier today, the Senate Majority Leader removed Tony Finch from the list of distinguished women to be honored by the state Senate.
The Wildwood Art Showcase is coming to the Barn in Albany. This one-night-only pop-up collaboration between Wildwood Schools and Albany Barn takes place on Thursday, May 25th. To tell us more, we're now joined by the Barn's Executive Director, Casey Palamain. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
So before we launch into the upcoming programming, some of our listeners may not be familiar with the Barn. So what should listeners know about your organization?
Albany Barn, Inc. Is an organization that provides support and professional development services to artists and creatives in the Capital Region. So that looks like a lot of different things. We have two locations, Albany Barn located in Arbor Hill in Albany, and Electric City Barn in the Hamilton Hill neighborhood in Schenectady. And across the two sites, we have low-cost living and workspace, apartments, private work studios, shared maker spaces. We provide, like I said, professional development services. So we help artists figure out how to grow their craft into a career. So if they've always wanted to teach a class but don't really know where to start, we can help them build that class. We can help them connect with organizations in the community where they could teach that class. You know, pretty much anything in the business side of being an artist. That's our sweet spot, and that's where we really like to help.
Now, both Hamilton Hill and Arbor Hill are low-income communities of color. You know, why did the Barn decide to settle into these communities as a way to, you know, help better promote art in the Capital District?
Well, you know, both Arbor Hill and Hamilton Hill, you know, at one point were really just thriving, thriving neighborhoods. And, you know, even now the folks that live in these neighborhoods are just so lovely. We've made so many great community and like neighborhood connections there. And, you know, it's just, it's just been a really nice place to be in both of these neighborhoods, and to kind of help break down, you know, any kind of barriers or I don't know, fears or even stereotypes that people can kind of unnecessarily have towards some of these spaces, like just us being there, us being able to connect with the neighbors and really figure out what the community wants and try to meet that need instead of just kind of coming in and assuming, you know, they know. So we've just had really, really wonderful experiences in both of these neighborhoods. And we love, you know, the Albany Barn building was a school for a very long time and was a community center after that, and a rec center, boxing gym kind of place. And we love when folks pop in and say, oh my gosh, I went to school here in the 60s. And, you know, this was my classroom. And there's just so much rich history in the neighborhood and in our buildings. So we're just really, honored to be able to take these to take over these buildings and to get to know the people that make up these really great neighborhoods.
And the Albany Barn, they're the barn in Albany, as you mentioned, in that former St. Joseph's Academy. Two of the things that are being addressed in that building are housing, specifically for a lower income bracket, and the private studio space. You talked about the creating sustainability for artists. Can you talk about how the access to both of these things are really important in improving the quality of art and the life of artists in the Capital Region?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, like you said, all of our spaces, you know, are low income. It's low income housing, low income, you know, like studio spaces to work. And it's really, they create a really nice safety net for artists, because, you know, a lot of these folks are quitting, you know, or attempting to quit their regular kind of day jobs, right, to put all of their efforts into growing their career as artists. So the fact that they can kind of have peace of mind that their rent will be low and will be stable, and then they can take the funds that they're saving in that area and put them into growing their career. It just creates a safe and secure environment where they are not afraid to take risks in their practice. And that's really the way that they're going to be able to grow and take off, is if they, you know, if they take risks. And that's kind of where we want to fit in, is we want to eliminate as much of that risk and that fear as possible. So that's through, you know, creating those affordable spaces and then all of the, you know, the services that we provide. But, you know, there's not a ton of studio space options in the area as well. So space for folks that live elsewhere but need a private space to do their work. And both the live side of what we do and the work side, we have lengthy wait lists. I think there's about 160 people on our housing wait list. So, you know, it's sad that there's so many folks out there that want to be in our space and we just don't have the room for them. But it's an indication for us that what we're doing is there's a real value to what we're offering in our spaces.
So you mentioned that the barn is also a space for collaboration, and, you know, one of the collaboration has been with Wildwood, used to teach artists to our classes there, now the Wildwood Art Showcase. What is sort of the structure of the barn's collaborative relationship with groups like the Wildwood Art Showcase?
Oh, we've been working with Wildwood for several years now, and it's just one of our favorite partnerships. The Art Showcase is one of my favorite events of the whole year that we do. So generally speaking, we partner with a lot of community organizations that want to bring art into their everyday practice in whatever their business might be, but they don't necessarily know how to do that or have the resources to do that. So Wildwood, you know, has all of these folks that that really have a passion for art, but they, you know, they wanted a way to really show that off and even to, you know, highlight what they're doing in terms of like teaching them, right? So where we come in is, we work with Wildwood to create some programming. So four of our artists went to the Wildwood schools, or, you know, spaces for learning, and they taught the Wildwood folks a bit more about, we covered collaging, fiber arts, food photography and African drum and dance. So our artists went to the spaces, shared their craft with the folks from Wildwood, and they, you know, made collaborative pieces. So they all, you know, wove on one loom and learned how to weave and the importance of weaving. And at the show tomorrow, those pieces that were created together with our artists and their artists will be on display. And we also create just a full visual art exhibition with pieces that our artists have created that, you know, are inspired by the pieces that some of the Wildwood artists have created. So it's just a really wonderful exhibition that highlights the barn and Wildwood and the really great things that can happen when two organizations that don't seem to have a ton in common can come together and share resources and learn from one another.
This recording will be rebroadcast in the morning, so that's Thursday, May 25th. You mentioned that this happens every year. Is that just specifically the Wildwood Art Showcase? Are there other showcases that take place every year?
The Wildwood Showcase is one that happens, that is regularly happening every year. We are always looking for new partnerships with individuals or community organizations. I love when we create something like we have with Wildwood, and it has, you know, its own legs and its own spirit, and it can happen every year. You know, we work with some local theater artists that call the barn their home now, and they do, you know, three or four different runs of theatrical production a year. So those shows change, but their presence is always there. So we have a lot of relationships like that that happen regularly, I'm happy to say.
So we go ahead.
Want to thank Casey Polamine for talking to us about the barn. If people want more information, both about the Wildwood event, but also about the barn in general, you have a website. How can people do that?
Absolutely. Our website is albanybarn.org. You can learn about how to support the work that we do or how to become a member or join as an artist. There's so many things that you can do to get involved and help us raise the barn, as we say.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
So to end tonight's show, Gabby's Garden is a community garden in downtown Albany, and Moses Nagel stopped by for their full moon planting party to talk about what's planted this season.
This is our food.
My garden during COVID, you know, living home alone, so I started plants and stuff. And I was looking for people who were, you know, community gardeners. And I happened to be in the neighborhood driving by, and I saw people out there gardening. So I just pulled over. I was like, yeah, you answered my prayers, universe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I pulled over, introduced myself, and I started volunteering, like, the very next weekend.
Was that last season, or?
This was 2 years ago, maybe?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now you just come for all the big events?
Yeah, well, I've been traveling for work, and now that, you know, things have been normalized a little bit, so we're in Rochester for months. Like, I go from Tuesday to Friday, and then when I get home, I'm just, like, happy to be home. So, yeah, I haven't been here for a while. I used to come pretty regularly, but I'm going to start picking back up, because, I very much enjoy it.
That's nice.
Yeah.
A triple?
Yeah.
Triple marshmallow?
But look at the brown.
It's getting there, but you could do a lot better than that, I think.
And you say you
did. I had a good brown top one, and it just fell in.
Last full moon, Gabby's Garden on Grand Street in Albany held a full moon planting party to work on the garden and have fun. There was a grill full of hot dogs and marshmallow roasting, with kids of all ages running around playing hide and seek. The garden on Grand Street has been around for a long time and has had contributions from the founders of Soulfire Farm and Youth Effects, along with many other downtown Albany residents that have passed through. Lex Begat and Aaron Johans helped organize the event and told me about the history of the garden.
So this place here, I'll just describe where we are. Right now, we are in Gabby's Garden.
Okay.
That's Gabby and the painting right there. Gabby's Garden is right behind the Free School. And this land here has belonged to the Friends of the Free School for a long time. Down below was a parking lot, like for much of the Free School's life. And then I don't know how or why, but you see the house right behind you there? So that's where Jeff used to live. And Jeff Root was Bowen Suchak's partner at Youth FX when Youth FX got started. And Jeff, before that cherry tree wasn't there, and Jeff used to project movies onto the wall of that building, which was abandoned at the time. From that window, he would project movies there. And so this became like a community space through like Grand Street Community Arts. And then Grand Street Community Arts had a program called Youth Organics, and somehow Youth Organics put in a lawn down there on what was the parking lot. They put in apple trees and a lawn, and it became a community space with a small garden. And then up here, the garden part was like the garden program of the free school forever. And then everything changed in 2020, you know. So before that, I don't know if you guys ever ate at the free school pre-2020, but the free school has always had an amazing lunch program with amazing food, and we would grow food for the school lunch program.
Yeah.
And that's how the garden functioned. It was like a teaching garden to make food for the lunch program. And then in 2020, there was no more school lunch and no more school in person. And so the raison d'etre for the garden changed, and suddenly we had tons of volunteers. So we just expanded. Like in 2020, we just like grew. We started so much new space. A lot of space here was just wood chipper lawn before, and like in 2020 we dramatically expanded, and we had tons of volunteers. And then in 2021 we had fewer, and then 2022.
So let's say the present, like what's the project, what's the idea right now?
Well, right now it's mostly just me and Lex. We've had a few core members who used to live in the neighborhood move out, and that's made it more difficult. We really want to keep volunteers as local as possible, but we know that a lot of people are really busy and stressed, and so if anybody did want to come out of the neighborhood to volunteer here, we're obviously not going to turn them away. One of the big things that I like to do with the garden is donate the food to the free food fridge. There's one located over on Elm Street.
The first one?
Yes, the very first free food fridge. And so I figure if we're gardening, this is obviously more food that I'm going to eat or be able to, you know, set aside for winter. But also, if we're having a community garden, the point is to be able to give back directly to the surrounding community. So that's why I like doing a little weekly harvest. And then, depending on how productive the garden can be, I know Food Not Bombs is also looking for additional produce donations. So this is also a small plug on their end for anyone who might be listening.
And they serve on Monday nights, is that
yep,
right?
Yep, serving is on Monday nights, so they would need the produce donations by Mondays at 4. And
where do they do it?
That is located at the SJC, which is located on Central Ave.
Right, right.
And their serving hours are every Monday from 5 to 7, which is pretty nice for me because our open garden volunteer hours are Sundays 10 to 2, and then Wednesdays from 5 to 7. So
that's the idea, is that those times anyone can come here and
yeah,
and
or at least
together,
that's the time when we'll be here
together.
But obviously if anyone wanted to come in, you know, to enjoy the space and see it any other time, they're more than welcome to. There's no gate here on the garden. Sometimes we have some people from the neighborhood who will come in and just sort of harvest on their own, and that's fine because that's what the food is here for. But obviously, you know, we prefer to kind of guide people when possible so that way they don't accidentally like harvesting something too early or pull out a plant that they shouldn't. And so I think what we would like to try and do is just let more people know about what Gabby's Garden is and to be able to help out. Two of the projects I know we're trying to work on right now, we're putting up a shed so that way we can store our tools for the winter so tools don't walk off or get left out and then weathered. And then I also want to try and put in a drip line system. So we're going to see how that goes. We're still transplanting right now, still fairly early in the season. But, you know, the garden work really ebbs and flows. So pretty much any time is a good time to drop in.
There's, like, a lot of infrastructure already. There's these cool sort of structures in the greenhouse already and stuff.
Yeah, these
right?
structures were built by Jonah and Leah when they lived in the neighborhood. This was... I don't know what that is. Oh, they're using
it's the palapa or whatever.
I feel like it was supposed to be an outdoor kitchen. That's how it's always referred to. And it has like rainwater catchment, but it's really just like shade.
It's a nice spot. We've, you know, hung out underneath it when it's rainy, and it's just.
We had a poetry under there during the rain. All spring.
Yeah.
And right now, as we speak, there's a bunch of kids serving themselves, using it as a bar service for root beer and marshmallows. So that's pretty cool.
They're gonna be party people. I can see it.
What have you done so far today for the
moon planting ceremony? For transplanting or
all of the transplants that we had Nate brought on Wednesday, okay. But you do have my 4 seed packets of green beans and cucumbers, which I was going to plant.
Okay, so we can
plant those.
We've been double digging, and I think we're going to be putting seeds in the ground.
And that's because of the super fertility of the moon right now, right?
Yes.
The whole full moon planting thing started like. It was a year or two ago when we had so many starts and the weather was so hot and dry. We were waiting for a cloudy day to transplant and there was like no cloudy days. And so then finally, like first week of June, we were like, we're just gonna like, let's just do it at night. Let's just have a full moon planting party. And so then was it last year or 2 years ago?
It was last year. Yeah. That was the first one. And also, low-key, this is a little bit of guerrilla gardening, so yeah. When's the best time to do guerrilla gardening? At night.
I would, like, otherwise, other cases I might ask, like, you know, just the bigger philosophy behind the whole thing. I feel like everybody kind of knows about community gardening and stuff. Like, I do like that you're kind of the free school, free garden connection, just the way that you're saying... It's kind of everybody's garden in a real way.
There's no fence.
That's pretty, yeah. Yes. It's really open.
People take whatever they want. That's pretty. Yeah. Sometimes there's crazy people throwing shovels. That's why we need the shed. There's crazy people throwing shovels at the apple tree to get apples to fall down. And I'll have to be like, hey, don't throw the shovel at the tree.
Gabby's garden is at 93 Grand Street. Drop-in hours are Sundays 10 to 2 and Wednesdays 5 to 7, and all are welcome. Reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this is Moses Nagel.
So when I first got married, we lived actually at the block from this garden, so interesting to hear what they're doing with it now. Memorial Day, of course, has always been a traditional day or weekend to plant gardens here in the Capital District. But due to climate change, that's been moved forward a week or two.
And that is our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Thank you to Sina for being our engineer tonight. We also want to thank all our volunteers who made today's episode possible, including Moses Nagel, who filed that last report, and Tom Rowe, Philip Grant, and the WGXC staff that provided us with the congressional update. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, supported by donations. If you have an independent donation, consider a gift, monthly donation, go to mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Media Sanctuary, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news, or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website and on your favorite podcast platform. We appreciate you listening. Until next time.